Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This year, Democracy Now! Turns 25 years old. That's right, 25 years of bringing you the voices and stories you won't hear in the corporate media. Democracy Now! Has always refused to take government or corporate funding because nothing is more important to us than our editorial independence. Nothing is more important to us than telling you the truth. But that means we rely on you, our audience, for support. Please visit democracynow.org right now and make your $25 contribution in honor of our 25th anniversary and help us stay on air for another 25 years and then another 25 after that. Thank you so much. And remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. New York, this is Democracy Now!
So far, 210 million doses of vaccine have been administered globally, but half of those are in just two countries, and 80% are in just 10 countries. More than 200 countries are yet to administer a single dose.
As the official global COVID death toll nears 2.5 million, more than 500,000 here in the U.S., much of the world is months, if not years, away from obtaining vaccines to slow the pandemic. Pressure is growing on President Biden and the World Trade Organization from protecting the intellectual property rights of Big Pharma, which is slowing down the manufacturing of COVID vaccines. We'll speak to a leading WTO delegate from South Africa, as well as Illinois Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. We'll also talk to her about the push to increase the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief package, and more. Then we look at the growing probes into the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol.
We cannot equate white nationalist violence with what my colleagues on the right stated as left-wing extremist violence. Equating a righteous movement for justice with hateful and racist white nationalism is outright ignorant and disingenuous on your part.
We'll speak to Brendan O'Connor, author of Blood Red Lines, How Nativism Fuels the Right. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. recorded over 3,200 deaths from COVID-19 Wednesday, even as new cases and hospitalizations remain on the decline. President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are taking part in a White House event today to mark the 50 millionth shot of a coronavirus vaccine under their administration, the halfway point in Biden's promise to deliver 100 million shots in his first 100 days. Nearly 14% of the U.S. population has now received at least one dose. The Food and Drug Administration took another step toward granting emergency use authorization to a third COVID-19 vaccine Wednesday, announcing a single dose of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine showed 86% efficacy against severe cases of disease in a U.S. trial. An advisory panel of vaccine experts meets Friday to discuss the findings, with the FDA set to authorize the vaccine as early as Saturday. This is White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Jeffrey Zients.
Johnson & Johnson has announced it aims to deliver a total of 20 million doses by the end of March. We're working with the company to accelerate the pace and time frame by which they deliver the full 100 million doses, which is required by contract by the end of June.
Moderna says it has produced a new version of its COVID-19 vaccine that offers better protection against a coronavirus variant first identified in South Africa. The modified vaccine will be tested as both a booster shot and as a primary vaccine, with further plans to test a multivalent booster that could protect people against multiple variants of coronavirus. This comes as researchers have identified a new variant in New York City and other parts of the northeastern U.S. that's evolved mutations similar to those seen in South Africa and elsewhere. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia says he will vote to confirm Interior Secretary nominee Deb Haaland. The move by the pro-fossil fuels Democrat could help Haaland overcome overwhelming Republican opposition to a confirmation as the first ever Native American cabinet member in the United States. Another Biden nominee, Neera Tanden, appears unlikely to be confirmed to lead the Office of Management and Budget after Senator Manchin and several key Republicans said they would vote against her. Democratic leaders of three Senate committees have delayed votes on Tanden's confirmation without announcing plans to reschedule them. The Biden administration's releasing the declassified intelligence report on the 2018 murder of Washington Post columnist Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi. The report's based largely on findings by the CIA. Reuters is reporting it will assert Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved and likely ordered Khashoggi's murder at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The White House said Wednesday President Biden will be speaking with Saudi Arabia's King Salman rather than the Crown Prince, who was always the contact for the Trump administration. Biden will be speaking reportedly with the king about the report. The Guardian reports more than 6,500 migrant workers from India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh and Sri Lanka have died in Qatar since it won the right in 2010 to host the 2022 World Cup. That's an average of 12 migrant worker deaths per week. Many of the dead were employed on construction sites for the World Cup's seven new soccer stadiums and massive public work projects tied to the upcoming tournament. Qatar's government claims most of the deaths were due to natural causes, but workers' advocates have tied many of them to heat stress from scorching temperatures at work sites, as well as workplace accidents, crowded and unsanitary conditions in labor camps, and deaths by suicide. In 2012, Democracy Now! Traveled to Qatar's capital, Doha, where we spoke with the Nepalese labor journalist Devendra Dungana.
They are living in very squalid conditions. You couldn't just believe. 17 people living in one room, 50 people sharing one small kitchen, and there's no fire extinguisher service there, no running water, and 50 people have to key up in the morning to use one toilet. They felt they were under captivity, and a kind of modern slavery was there in Qatar because their passports were seized by the company and they will not have the right to return home even in emergency situations because they are not easily issued the exit papers.
To see our interview with journalist Devendra Dungana in Doha about the plight of Qatar's migrant workers, go to democracynow.org. At least 41 migrants drowned in the Mediterranean after their ship capsized en route from Libya to European shores. The boat had at least 120 people on board. An estimated 17,000 people have died while attempting the treacherous journey since 2014, described by the United Nations as the most dangerous migration route in the world. Amnesty International's revoked prisoner of conscience status for jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, citing his past hateful, xenophobic and violent comments. In 2007, Navalny published a video comparing Muslims in Russia's North Caucasus region to cockroaches who should be shot with a pistol. Another video from the early 2000s shows Navalny dressed as a dentist comparing immigrant workers to rotten teeth that need to be removed. Amnesty says it will continue to fight for Navalny's freedom even after removing him from its list of prisoners of conscience. In Ecuador, officials say 79 prisoners were killed in gang-related riots across three prisons this week. The UN's called for an investigation. Ecuador's prisons suffer from overcrowding despite a release of some prisoners during the pandemic. Back in the United States, prisoners at the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola have gone on hunger strike after they were kept in solitary confinement past the end of their disciplinary sentences. The prisoners are being held in unheated 9-foot by 6-foot cells with only a jumpsuit and a sheet despite record low temperatures this month. They're allowed just 1 hour of outside access per day. United Nations human rights experts have repeatedly said solitary confinement practices in the U.S. amount to torture. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has signed legislation making Illinois the first state to end cash bail payments for people seeking release from jail as they await their day in court. It's part of a sweeping package of criminal justice reforms signed into law Monday. Illinois State Representative Justin Slaughter called the legislation progress against a criminal justice system rooted in racism in a state where black people make up 14% of the population, but more than half of all prisoners.
With this bill, we take aim at our overly punitive sentencing policies. We provide more judicial discretion for mandatory minimums. We offer alternatives to custody. And of course, and we're going to be saying it over and over again, we end our unfair cash bail system, a system that relies on one's financial ability or inability to post bond.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in the states of New York, Massachusetts, and Virginia are suing the bail bond company Libre by Nexus for predatory practices against jailed immigrants. Libre's business model consists of paying prisoners bonds, then charging exorbitant fees while forcing people to wear electronic tracking bracelets, which New York Attorney General Letitia James called shackles. Libre would then recoup the bond when trials started. Libre also threatened borrowers who were not able to repay with deportation or re-imprisonment, even though they had no power to do so. Federal prosecutors have charged former New York City police officer Thomas Webster for assault with a deadly weapon during the January 6th insurrection. Prosecutors say Webster went after a Capitol police officer, quote, like a junkyard dog, teeth clenched and fists clenched, beating him with a metal pole and trying to gouge out the officer's eye. Webster is a former U.S. Marine and a 20-year veteran of the New York Police Department who once helped guard City Hall and the mayor's mansion. In immigration news, President Biden's reversed the Trump administration's ban on green cards issued outside the United States. The move paves the way for certain family members to reunify in the U.S. with relatives who are citizens or permanent residents. Biden's executive order also restores temporary visas to some categories of foreign workers, including highly skilled workers, managers, and au pairs. In more immigration news, lawyers say they've recently found the parents of 105 migrant children who were ripped from their families by the Trump administration. The parents of over 500 separated children still have yet to be found, and over half of them were likely deported, according to the lawyers. In Missouri, Honduran immigrant Alex Garcia left a church in the St. Louis suburb of Maplewood Wednesday after spending more than 1,200 days living in sanctuary. The Trump administration had scheduled the married father of five to be deported in 2017. Garcia emerged from sanctuary after freshman Missouri Congressmember Cori Bush introduced a private bill to grant him permanent residency. And here in New York, longtime immigration activist Marco Saavedra has won political asylum, setting a legal precedent for undocumented activists seeking refugee status in the United States. Saavedra was born to an indigenous family in Oaxaca, Mexico, and brought to the U.S. as a child. He's been involved in several high-profile immigration actions. In 2012, he purposely got arrested by federal authorities to infiltrate the privately owned Broward Transitional Center in Florida, where he helped organize imprisoned asylum seekers. Marco Saavedra spoke to Democracy Now! In 2019 about his appeal for asylum.
I would be for the first time looking, you know, and being able to plan my life, you know, 10 years down the road, and for the first time actually, you know, feel fully accepted in the only country that I've known for the most of my life. So I think that it would be monumental. And then I think more significantly, it would be monumental for the immigrant rights movement that someone that, with my track history, could benefit from this protection and set precedent for other human rights activists that could also benefit from this very severe war that exists in my country with organized crime and drug trafficking, and could hopefully also be seen as worthy of asylum.
Again, Marco Saavedra just granted political asylum in the United States. To see our extended interview with him, visit democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Special hi to Nermeen Sheikh, co-hosting from a remote location. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
As the global COVID death toll nears 2.5 million, half a million of those deaths here in the United States, we begin today's show looking at how intellectual property rights are preventing much of the world from obtaining COVID vaccines. In the United States, over 45 million people have received at least their first dose of a vaccine. But across much of the world, COVID vaccines will not be available for months, if not years. The United Nations recently warned 130 countries have not received any vaccines at all, leading to what some have described as a vaccine apartheid system. South Africa and India are heading a push by over 100 nations for the World Trade Organization to waive intellectual property rules that give pharmaceutical companies monopolistic control over vaccines they developed, even when those vaccines are developed largely with public funds. Last fall, the Trump administration blocked a temporary waiver on the rules known as TRIPS. That's the WTO's agreement on trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights. The Biden administration is now facing increasing pressure from public citizen and other groups to reverse the U.S. position ahead of a key meeting on Monday. Lori Wallach is director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch.
Right now, thanks to rules like in the World Trade Organization's trade-related intellectual property agreement, countries all over the world are required, despite having invested hundreds of billions in creating the vaccines, they're required to give monopoly protections under the WTO rules to the pharmaceutical companies, who then control how much and where the needed medicines are produced. In order to be able to gear up, we need a broad waiver that covers that whole web of intellectual property rights that Big Pharma right now has that's constricting the ability of countries around the world to make these meds.
We're joined right now by two guests. Here in the United States, Democratic Congresswoman Jen Schakowsky represents the 9th District of Illinois. She's also Senior Chief Deputy Whip and Chair of the Consumer Protection and Commerce Subcommittee. And Mr. Kim Dgama is with us from Geneva. He's the counselor at the South African Permanent Mission to the World Trade Organization. He helped draft a proposal co-sponsored by India and South Africa calling for the WTO to suspend intellectual property rights related to COVID-19. Mustakim Dagama, let's begin with you. If you can explain to a global audience exactly what is happening, if nothing else this pandemic has told us, has taught us, if one person is sick somewhere, we are all threatened. What exactly, especially for an audience in the United States who hardly even knows that the World Trade Organization exists, are you saying will make an enormous difference in protecting the population of the planet?
Good morning, and good morning to all viewers. I think the point you make is very, very important. We have seen the interconnectedness of the world, and certainly COVID-19 has brought this to a fore. This proposal essentially proposes that we waive certain forms of intellectual property rights to ensure an increase of production. And we've seen large-scale shortages of vaccines, not because of any other reason, but because of the inappropriate use of intellectual property rights. And so from that perspective, the proposal really seeks to ensure that everyone has access, as you clearly also point out, that on a global scale, we see the variants of the virus now impacting the efficacy of vaccines that already have been produced. And so from this perspective, it makes a lot of sense to have everyone vaccinated at the earliest point in time. And so the waiver makes the argument that we should enable more producers to produce, to scale, and to ensure that all of us are safe in the shortest possible time. If we do not have access to a vaccine, the inequality that we see in the world today will continue. I emphasized a few days ago that only 10 countries are responsible for 75% of all vaccines that have been administered to date. And this means that a good 130 countries have not yet received vaccines at this point in time and may not receive vaccines for years to come.
Mustaqim, if you could also comment on the fact that AstraZeneca, for example, which was made in conjunction with the University of Oxford, AstraZeneca has licensed the Serum Institute of India to both produce and manufacture this vaccine. How did AstraZeneca do that? Is it entirely up to individual companies to make the decision about whether they license or not and to whom they license? Was a waiver required for AstraZeneca to do this?
Absolutely no. I think the licensing of AstraZeneca to the Serum Institute is what is called a voluntary license. So the waiver was not required to do this. But the problem with these types of arrangements, firstly, is that they're very secretive. Secondly, there are contractual terms that limit the producer, both in terms of volume and also geographic distribution of what is being produced. So the Serum Institute is one example. Johnson & Johnson has also licensed their vaccine to a company in South Africa. Once again, we know that from this particular contract, only 9% of what that company produces will be distributed in South Africa. The rest will go somewhere else. So whereas voluntary licenses would be a good idea, it is limited in scope, and what is required to address COVID-19 cannot be addressed purely through voluntary licenses. So the clear bottom line here is that we need a massive scale-up. And the rights that are embedded in these voluntary licenses enable companies to say how much is produced, for whom they are produced, and at what price. And ultimately, if we have a limitation in the number of vaccines that are produced, we know that this has an impact on the price. It has an impact on scarcity. And what we do see in the market now is that even poor countries are required to pay much more for these vaccines, even though these vaccines would have been developed with a large amount of public funding.
And does this waiver apply not only to vaccines that were developed in Europe and here, in other words, to Pfizer and Moderna, or also to vaccines that have been developed elsewhere, the two vaccines from China, as well as Sputnik V from Russia?
This is a measure that will apply everywhere. So all WTO members would be able to benefit and invoke the flexibility that is granted. So any vaccine that could be accessible could be subject to this particular waiver. And this is in line with the principle of non-discrimination, that we are not only targeting producers in particular countries. I think the problem that has arisen is that these producers are not willing to share the technology available. And as you indicate, it's not only applicable to vaccines, it's applicable to a broad range of intellectual property rights, including therapeutics, for example, diagnostics. In order to track and trace the evolution of the virus, we need access to further types of technology. So it's not only vaccines that would be applicable here, but it would also apply to a wider range of intellectual property rights, and then, of course, products that could be used to address COVID-19.
Congressmember Jan Schakowsky, let's talk concretely about what this all means. I mean, you have private companies like Moderna that got, what, something like $1 billion from the United States, overall something like $2.5 billion for the development of the company's vaccines from governments around the world. So And then you have Pfizer, who may not have got it at the front end, but at the back end, a guarantee of massive buys by government, you know, sales of the vaccine. What exactly happens? What would, if there was a waiver to this WTO provision, would other companies and other countries be able to do?
So the waiver, which, by the way, is limited in time, it is narrowly focused on making sure that we address this current virus. And it would not change the rule of the WTO permanently. So this is an important response. And what it would do would be allow countries to be able to produce their own vaccines and therapeutics and make sure that they can take care of themselves. We know that these intellectual property rights really do put profit over people all over the world. And we know, and I've talked to in a hearing with these major companies, and I think emphasizing the fact that Americans are huge investors in this. We have put millions and millions of dollars into developing these vaccines and doing the research and development for these companies. But now they are saying, and they said in here, while they agree that the COVID virus anywhere threatens people everywhere, that they don't believe that they should allow this waiver so that other countries and other companies can develop their own drugs.
So concretely, it would mean sharing the recipe, essentially, and it would mean, you know, what are the some companies could make the needles. Some companies could make whatever needs to be done, and this would be shared for a time. And again, as you said, billions have gone into these companies by governments. This wasn't just developed by these companies outlaying money.
You know, I think it's kind of analogous to allowing various countries to produce a generic drug based on the research that has been done. It is so short-sighted. And the United States of America is not on the bright side of this right now. What we would like is between now and Monday for the president of the United States, and, you know, I'm certainly supporting of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, would say that we support the waiver at the WTO. It would make all the difference in the world. I know that Nancy Pelosi, our Speaker of the House, has spoken out on this issue as well and says that this is important for us to do for ourselves. It's our own self-interest as well. We don't want to, you know, we're spending additional billions of dollars to address tourism, to help the airlines, to be able to help our economy. All of that will be for naught if we cannot protect ourselves against this virus because we will not help the international community. And there are hundreds of organizations, health organizations, human rights organizations, NGOs around the world that are pleading really for this waiver to be approved.
And Mustaqim, could you respond to those who oppose this waiver, not on the basis of profit, but simply on the basis of the fact that they say these vaccines, in particular Pfizer and Moderna, which are very difficult to transport and store, given the fact that they need to be kept in sub-freezing temperatures, that the problem is not one of sharing the technology, because, in fact, even if they were to share this so-called recipe, no other country or most countries would not be able to manufacture these vaccines because they don't have the technology and the means to make these particular vaccines. And then also, what exactly happened with the AIDS vaccine during the, not the vaccine, but the antiretroviral drugs during the AIDS epidemic, and how those drugs were able to be manufactured around the world, in particular in India.
Yes, thanks. I think this is a very important point to stress, that in terms of the manufacturing capacity, we know that there are many developing countries that do have the capacity to produce vaccines. And if you actually look at the supply chains, much of the medicine consumed in the West is actually produced in developing countries. And so from that perspective, firstly, if the recipe is shared, as you say, with developing countries, there are manufacturers that can do this. The World Health Organization, for instance, has a so-called pre-qualification list of vaccine producers, and a big part of these manufacturers actually come from the developing world. Even the mRNA vaccines that have been developed by Moderna, for example, can easily be produced in the developing world because mRNA technology is not new. It's been applied in other areas, but the current application to COVID-19 is novel, but the scientific base and the competence actually does exist in the developing world. And so from that perspective, I think that that kind of narrative has been debunked by various organizations. I also wanted to indicate that in terms of the second part of your question on HIV and AIDS, this is a very sad chapter in our history. And I think some of the remnants from that episode really still does chime in the current history. At that time, countries like India could produce on the basis of an amendment that was made to the TRIPS agreement. Unlike what we are proposing, or at least very much like what we are proposing now, a decision was taken to allow countries that do not have manufacturing capacity to import from countries that do have. And so, in theory, this mechanism is available for countries currently. However, given the scale of the pandemic, we certainly also see that it affects everyone, and so these flexibilities are not easily accessible. And so from that point of view, when we look at the history of HIV and AIDS and we look at some of the other pandemics, it is very clear that the only way that we are going to address this is to really get a global scale-up of vaccines, whatever is needed, to ensure that we vaccinate everyone in the shortest possible time. And you've indicated what the risks are. The risks are not only on the health side. It's also on the side of poverty alleviation. A lot of people have now been exposed to insecurity, and the longer we have lockdowns continuing, the longer people will be exposed to hunger and increasing levels of poverty.
And finally, very quickly, sorry, Mustaqim, just very quickly before we conclude, just earlier this month, the WTO appointed the first African and the first woman to head the organization. Your sense, and she's also, of course, urged member states to make vaccines more accessible. Do you think her being in this position might make a difference?
Yes, I think firstly, being a woman and being the first African to lead this organization, she is in touch with the sensitivities and I think the requirements of developing countries. So there could be no better person to lead the organization at this point in time. She's already indicated that she's willing to work constructively with members to ensure that we have an outcome. And I think we welcome this kind of positive energy that's been injected into the organization, and hopefully it could also help us to reach an outcome in the shortest possible time to ensure that we save lives and that we hold our governments to account to ensure that public interest and public health issues are taken account and also are promoted above narrow interest that we see, for instance, with pharmaceutical companies.
And finally, Congressmember Jan Schakowsky, what exactly has to happen by Monday? And do you have any indication from President Biden, Vice President Harris, like you do from Nancy Pelosi, who you say has come out in support of the waiver? What happens Monday?
Well, there's a letter that we're getting sign-ons from members of Congress to the President of the United States. A lot of contact now with the administration, really emphasizing the importance of the leadership of the United States of America. We saw a quote from one of the lawyers for the pharmaceutical companies who said they don't do this out of the goodness of their heart. They want to do it because they get the benefits. And we're talking about profits here. It's wrong in so many different ways, including putting Americans in danger. So we're just going to keep the pressure on because time is a wasting here. If we don't start getting more vaccines and pharmaceuticals to these developing and poor countries, we will continue to be at risk no matter how much money we spend to crush the virus.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us and ask you, Congressmember Schakowsky, to stay with us because we want to talk in our next segment about the fight for 15. That's $15 an hour. And we want to thank Mustakeem Dagama, counselor at the South African Permanent Mission to the WTO, joining us from Geneva, Switzerland. And we'll continue to follow this story. This is Democracy Now! Back with Congressmember Schakowsky in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. The House votes Friday on President Biden's $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package that includes a $15 an hour minimum wage increase. The measure remains at risk in the Senate, where it faces opposition from Democrats Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema. Manchin instead proposed an increase to just $11 an hour. If the minimum wage doesn't survive in this bill, Biden has said he's open to legislation, but that would need 60 votes in the Senate to overcome a filibuster. This comes as Vice News reports leaked internal documents show how McDonald's spies on workers who are part of the fight for $15 campaign. Quote, McDonald's intelligence analysts have used a social media monitoring tool to collect and scrape data openly available online and to help it monitor social media accounts. The sources told Motherboard that the company's intelligence analysts have attempted to use the tool to reconstruct the friends lists and networks of workers involved in the labor movement using fake Facebook personas in order to figure out their strategy, counter it, and find out where the key players are and who they know. Unquote. Congressmember Joan Schakowsky, you've pushed to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. You're chair of the Consumer Protection and Commerce Subcommittee. Can you talk about what's happening right now, what it means that the Senate parliamentarian makes a decision whether or not this will be included, but whether they move ahead with this anyway or make it a separate bill? Why $15 an hour is so important?
Well, we've been pushing for $15 an hour for a very long time. And as you know, it's phased in. And there are states like Washington State that for a long time have had $15 an hour. The current minimum wage federally is $7.25. Now, you can't live on that. You can't raise a family on that. You have to have other jobs. That's about $30,000 a year. You just can't really make it. And so we need to do this now in the United States. You know, Reverend Barber made a brilliant statement. He said, you know, the minimum wage during slavery was zero. And in all these years since then, we've gotten to $7.25. It is time now, really, to move toward a living wage. I would say that the we're certainly pushing for five, and finally going to get to five, I believe. And it should be in this package. In fact, the Senator Byrd, when he was in the Congress, made a whole speech about the importance of the minimum wage being raised. And we talk about the Byrd rule, which would disqualify things like the minimum wage, so it is said. And so we're saying that it is perfectly consistent with this package to include the minimum wage. And those colleagues of mine who think that it is too high, that we have to have perhaps a regional wage, are so disrespectful. And they have the nerve to use the excuse that it's really going to be bad for people with disabilities. It's going to be bad for low-income people because jobs will be lost. There is no evidence of that whatsoever. Raising the minimum wage does nothing but good for millions of Americans.
And Congressmember Schakowsky, could you explain who exactly is opposing the inclusion of the $15 minimum wage, and also whether the so-called reconciliation process can be used with this proposal? What is that process?
Okay, the reconciliation process does allow us, us Democrats right now, to pass a big bill. $1.9 trillion is what's been on the table with 51 votes, and that's it. We would have to break the tie with Kamala Harris, the vice president, coming in and doing that, but we can do that. About 80% of Americans want us to do this. So first of all, it's the Republicans who are against this legislation altogether. There's so many things that they don't want to see in this bill, but particularly, I would say, raising the minimum wage. Beyond that, there are a couple of Democrats still in the Senate that are saying that they don't want that. And there's a lot of pressure being directed at them, phone calls from constituents in their district, a mobilization of grassroots people to try and change their mind. And we're not ready to give up yet. I should say to give up at all. We're going to press and press for including this as one of the most important aspects, raising the wage, having people be able to take care of themselves and not rely on many of the benefits, which I approve of, that we want to do to help them. But people want to help themselves and they want to have jobs that actually provide for themselves and their families. So the reconciliation process would allow us to do that with just 51 votes instead of the 60 that would normally be required, unfortunately, because of the filibuster in the United States Senate.
Finally, on a different issue, Congressmember Jan Schakowsky, this week, one day after another, there have been hearings on the January 6th insurrection. In our next segment, we're about to really delve into who was part of that. But I wanted to ask you about the high level of involvement of military, of police and retired police. Today, we just reported in headlines about a New York police officer who engaged in one of the most vicious attacks on a Capitol police officer, trying to rip off his helmet, gouging his eye, and then slamming him with a pole. He has just been arrested. But the percentage of the protesters being from the military or police organizations, your thoughts?
Well, we're going to pass the legislation on Justice in Policing Act because this is not a new story about violence too often that occurs among law enforcement. We're also finding out and really seeing every single day, in fact, the disparities between how people of color are treated as opposed to whites. I think this is part of the story of January 6th. And we're going to have a full investigation and accountability. And we're going to have to make changes in the law that enforce accountability. There is no question about it. And, we're going to have to look at the military and the police, who very often have immunity and in an unjust way for the kinds of atrocities and that are done. So, again, Nancy Pelosi is creating a task force that is going to and a commission that's going to be looking into all of these details. And then we will take appropriate actions to make sure that
We just have 20 seconds, but you recently wrote to Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg demanding more information on the company's anti-extremism measures, citing multiple reports that some of Facebook's own staff were concerned about the, quote, rapid spread of extremism and disinformation on Facebook. What are the responsibility of these social media giants to tackle extremism? And do you favor anti-monopoly legislation against them, breaking them up?
I actually do, but mainly what we're talking about now is, again, accountability for hosting the QAnon and other extremist organizations. And every click is really money for them. And so we've heard lots of apologies. It's too little, too late. And now we need to have accountability of these platforms, that they take responsibility for what's on those platforms.
We want to thank you for being with us, Democratic Congresswoman Jen Schakowsky from Illinois, Senior Chief Deputy Whip and Chair of the Consumer Protection and Commerce Subcommittee. Next up, we look at the growing probes into the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Stay with us. Close as a rabbit gets to a diamond by Captain Beefheart and his magic band. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. This is the Quarantine Report. As we end today's show looking at the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, federal prosecutors have charged former New York City police officer Thomas Webster with assault with a deadly weapon during the insurrection. Prosecutors say he went after a Capitol police officer, quote, like a junkyard dog, teeth clenched and fists clenched, beating him with a metal pole and trying to gouge out his eye. Prosecutors say video shows Webster beat the officer with his hands and rip their gear off, causing them to choke because it, quote, cut off the officer's air. The video of this is horrifying. Webster's a former U.S. Marine and a 20-year veteran of the NYPD who once helped guard City Hall and the mayor's mansion. This comes as the Senate held its first public hearing Tuesday on the insurrection, where security officials blamed intelligence failures. The House Judiciary Committee followed up Wednesday with a hearing on the rise of domestic terror. Some Republican members tried to compare the January 6th attack to protests against police killings of Black Americans and insisted Antifa is a threat. This was Democratic Congresswoman Cori Bush's response.
We cannot equate white nationalist violence with what my colleagues on the right stated is left-wing extremist violence. Equating a righteous movement for justice with hateful and racist white nationalism is outright ignorant and disingenuous on your part. But for white supremacy, in which you benefit, we would not be in the streets demanding to be heard. We're demanding to be heard to save lives. And let me say this, had you fixed it before now, we wouldn't be here. And there are not fine people on both sides. There is simply no comparison.
Meanwhile, during this week's confirmation hearings for President Biden's nominee to become the next attorney general, Merrick Garland told the Senate Judiciary Committee he would prioritize prosecuting the white supremacists who stormed the Capitol January 6th. He compared the task to his prosecution of the Oklahoma City federal building bombing in 1990s, when Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois asked Garland if the deadly insurrection was a, quote, one-off. This was Judge Garland's response.
I don't think that this is necessarily a one-off. FBI Director Wray has indicated that the threat of domestic terrorism and particularly of white supremacist extremists is his number one concern in this area. This is coupled with an enormous rise in hate crimes over the past few years. There is a line from Oklahoma City. And there's another line from Oklahoma City all the way back to the experiences that I mentioned in my opening with respect to the battles of the original Justice Department against the Ku Klux Klan. We must do everything in the power of the Justice Department to prevent this kind of interference with the policies of American democratic institutions. And I plan, if you confirm me for Attorney General, to do everything in my power to ensure that we are protected.
This comes as former President Trump is set to reemerge Sunday as the headline speaker at CPAC. That's the Conservative Political Action Conference, where he'll try to keep alive his false claims of election fraud and reportedly will talk about running for president again in 2024. Well, for more, we're joined by reporter and author Brendan O'Connor, whose recent book is titled Blood Red Lines, How Nativism Fuels the Right. His latest article for The Guardian headlined, "The Capitol riot wasn't a fringe uprising. It was enabled by very deep pockets." Welcome to Democracy Now!, Brendan. Talk about those pockets. Talk about this insurrection and who enabled it.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I mean, the events of January 6th were not just months, but years, decades in the making. And I think that Merrick Garland is correct to say that there's an ideological lineage reaching all the way back to the KKK and the Justice Department struggles against it, and really even further to Reconstruction and the Civil War. This is a current and a tendency in American politics that has been with us since the beginning and is being given expression and being encouraged by the conditions of crisis that we are all living in now.
Talk specifically about the funding of what took place on January 6th.
So on January 6th, the rally that then President Trump spoke at that preceded the siege of the Capitol was funded, and the infrastructure for it was provided by a slew of right-wing organizations that have gotten funding from various, you know, right-wing, from the right-wing donor class, that have been with us and, you know, that were involved in funding the Tea Party movement, that have been involved in blocking various Democratic efforts at passing progressive legislation over the years, and then saw that this was an opportunity to try to ingratiate themselves and support the militant white nationalist factions within the Republican Party that Trump finds to be his base.
And so, Brendan, as we heard earlier, Biden's nominee for Attorney General, Merrick Garland, has said that this will be his top priority, prosecuting the white supremacists who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. Now, given the fact that you've talked about the funding behind this, how do you think he can go about doing this if he is confirmed?
That's a good question. I think that the Justice Department's investigations, and already we've seen that the charges that have been brought have shown us a lot about the social dynamics of what happened on January 6th and in the weeks and months leading up to it, the way that these different groups are organized and the way that more organized groups interact with the Trump rank and file. I'm not optimistic that Merrick Garland's prospective investigation will be able to get to the root causes of how this happened and why this happened, not through any individual fault of Merrick Garland's or any individual prosecutor within the Justice Department, but simply because that's not the role of the Justice Department. They don't have the ideological framework or the political toolbox to be able to get to the root of these problems.
And Brendan, could you also elaborate on some of the groups that have been identified as having participated in this attack, including the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, and so on?
For sure. So the Oath Keepers are an older group that were very active during the Obama administration, that kind of served as a bridge between the far-right patriot movement that emerged during the late 80s and 90s. Oath Keepers draw their base of support from law enforcement and military veterans. There's a lot of overlap between these two groups. They were active on January 6th alongside the Proud Boys, who are a newer group that were founded in 2016, but were sort of laughed off by many of the more hardcore white nationalists for several years, until now in 2019, 2020, stepping into a power vacuum on the far right that was left by the collapse of the so-called alt-right. And the Proud Boys are basically a street fighting organization. Their base of support is primarily in the Pacific Northwest, but they're all over the country. And they, similarly to the Oath Keepers, serve as a bridge between the more ideologically hardcore far right and the Trump base. And they do this by deploying the tropes and mythology of QAnon, of evangelical Christianity, of ultra-nationalist patriotism, all in service of open street violence.
During the hearing on Tuesday, Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin used his questioning to read from a Federalist article promoting a conspiracy theory that the rioters infiltrated a crowd of well-meaning and festive Trump supporters.
A very few didn't share the jovial, friendly, earnest demeanor of the great majority. Some obviously didn't fit in. And he describes four different types of people: plainclothes militants, agents provocateurs, fake Trump protesters, and then disciplined, uniformed column of attackers. I think these are the people that probably planned this.
So Ron Johnson keeps putting forward that this was Antifa. And then you have Marjorie Taylor Greene, the QAnon congresswoman, who said the same thing. And yet it now has come out with video that's emerged of one of her closest friends, one of the Trump-supporting protesters, marching along there and talking about the organizing of this event. So she knows full well exactly who is doing this, though she denied that that is who was doing it. Brendan O'Connor, if you can talk about where you feel this all needs to lead, and are these groups getting stronger?
Are these groups getting stronger? That's a very good question, and it's hard exactly to say. I think a lot of it will depend on how the fractures within the Republican Party writ large resolve themselves. If Congressmen, people like Marjorie Greene and senators like Ron Johnson are able to take over the party, then this becomes a habitable refuge for the organized far right. If, on the other hand, the more mainstream donor class and sections of the ruling class that affiliate with the Republican Party are able to reassert control, then the far right will take on a more anti-state character, and the accelerationist and fascist factions will gain influence, I think. And that can, that will lead in a different direction, neither of which neither of which I'm very optimistic about.
We have 20 seconds, but the subtitle of Blood Red Lines, your book, How Nativism Fuels the Right. You have Stephen Miller now briefing conservative Congress members, Trump coming out at CPAC Sunday. Your thoughts?
Yes, I think that the nativist influence is going to continue to rise, especially as the climate crisis deepens and more people around the world are displaced and come to countries like the United States seeking safety and refuge and comfort. This is going to provoke a reaction that those of us on the left and in the Democratic Party need to be conscientious and sensitive to as we think about how to build a world that can accommodate
everyone.
We're
going to have to leave it there. Brendan O'Connor, author of Blood Red Lines. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.